This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Being bullied, harassed, or hazed at school can be a frightening experience, and it can stay with you for a long time. That's the case for VPR commentator Marilyn Webb Nagley, who related her story a couple of years ago.
As a child, I was once unexpectedly shoved outside school by an older girl who cornered me when I tried to break away. An upperclassman told her to stop, but she ignored him with a defiant grin. Then, out of nowhere, my 230-pound grandmother appeared in her oversized car. I'll never know why she came for me that day, but I was very glad to see her. And my schoolmate never bullied me again.
Nagley was fortunate that her grandmother showed up at the right time. But what happens when a child isn't so lucky? And what steps should a parent take in the aftermath of an aggressive episode? That's what we're going to look at today. What tools and resources parents should be aware of when their child reports being the target of aggression or of witnessing bullying or hazing, and how schools can handle the situation. We're joined now by Jeff Lawrence, associate principal at Otter Valley Union High School in Brandon. Jeff is one of two designated employees at the school. Those are staff members specially trained to handle these kinds of complaints. Jeff, welcome to Vermont Edition. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Curtis Reed is the executive director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity. The partnership has updated a pamphlet for parents on dealing with aggression in schools. And Curtis is also a member of Vermont's Hazing, Harassment, and Bullying Prevention Advisory Council. Curtis, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Curtis, how much of a problem is bullying in Vermont?
Well, social aggression in schools is a great problem. I mean, it's there is not a day that a child is not harassed or bullied or hazed. The dimension of the problem, we're still trying to nail down sort of real figures, real data. One of the challenges is that the Agency of Education doesn't have the resources. Doesn't have adequate resources in terms of data collection and analysis and training.
So you believe it's a problem, but it's hard to quantify the problem?
Correct.
Jeff Lawrence, what about for you? Maybe you can localize to Otter Valley Union High School. I mean, certainly no school wants to say we're the poster child for bullying and harassment, but it's also something that is a problem at all schools. I mean, this happens. And so how do you address it? How much of an issue do you think it is?
It's a good point you raised that no school would ever say that, wants to say that we have a lot of bullying going on. At the same time, I would say that no school can say we don't have any going on. With the way the students interact and things that happen, it is a problem. And, one instance of bullying or harassment or hazing is a big problem in our schools. And once again, it's hard to quantify. Even as I look at our numbers of events that have taken place, reports that have come in, sometimes those reports, we're able to identify what happened. Other times we find that it really wasn't an event of bullying, but it was misconduct by a student.
About how many cases, as I said, you're a designated employee, so when a case is reported by a parent or by a student, the designated employees at their school are required to be notified. So how many cases do you have to address each year?
It varies, of course.
Sure.
But I would say I probably address, with bullying and harassment, probably 30 or 35 cases a year. But once again, any time a report is made, I have to follow up with the investigation. It doesn't mean that each of those times we found it to be bullying or harassment, or some of those times through mediation, we settle it informally halfway through the process.
Curtis Reed, as I mentioned, you've just updated a pamphlet from the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity about how parents can help deal with this. So you're steeped in these issues yourself. There are differences between bullying, harassment, and hazing. Can you differentiate between them for me?
Sure. Harassment involves what we call protected categories. That means that the aggression is based on your race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, etc. Bullying is really intended towards other sort of characteristics. Might be your weight, might be the clothes you wear, it might be they just don't like the way you look today. And then hazing is sort of a ritual to allow someone to be part of a group. The distinction between the three, and what's important about the shift in our brochure this year, is that the legislature created similar chronology or identical chronology and events that take place when these incidents are reported. Previously, harassment, if you were, if you were in a protected category, then you were mandated a chronology and mandated events that needed to take place.
When you say a chronology, you mean what has to happen once an incident has been reported, like what the school is required to do?
Correct. Like within the first 24 hours of a report, then the designated employee should transfer that into written. If it's given orally, an investigation needs to start. Within 5 days, the investigation needs to be completed. 30 days out is the option for your appeals.
And Chad Barrett, Jeff Lawrence, you actually deal with all of these types of cases at Otter Valley. So you'll have to look at a case of harassment versus a case of bullying versus hazing at the school.
Yes. And actually, in the just over 2 years that I've been here at Otter Valley, hazing has not come up as an issue, but the other two have.
We're talking today about bullying. We're looking at school-based aggression. Sometimes it doesn't even happen on school campus anymore, and we know that's a problem that schools are really struggling with, what happens with internet-based aggression that comes from classmates. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Has your child been bullied at school? And when your son or daughter approached you about it, did you know how to react? Did you know what steps to take? Were you satisfied with the school's action on the matter? Maybe you are a school administrator or have been, and you have a particular perspective on this about how schools can deal with it. If you want to weigh in or share your experiences, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Annie says, I found that I mostly had to teach my children how to create boundaries. I also frequently found I had to teach teachers how to create them as well. And I always kept my mind open to my own child's behavior. MB says, my kids went to a private school until third grade where they had what they called recess chat. They learned how to talk to each other after recess in order to work things out themselves in a civil manner. They were more attentive and able to learn after recess. When peers are held accountable and given a safe place to talk, bullying behavior is minimized. Unfortunately, entering the public school in fourth grade, my son was bullied at recess. He came home one day with his shirt ripped at the neck and another day bruised from being pushed into the lockers. I spoke to the teacher and principal multiple times and documented every conversation. I read the school handbook, which did not address bullying, and I consulted Vermont statutes. Yet using this information, I still was told by the principal that my son was not bullied. The counselor at school had the two boys meet, much to my dismay, and my son read a letter telling the boy how much he hurt him. He was never bullied again. The school handbook for the next year was amended with stronger language, yet I still hear of bullying at the elementary school. Curtis and Jeff, I'd love for both of you to weigh in on that. But Curtis, maybe you first, since MB is a parent. What do you advise parents when their child comes home and either reports to them or is clearly in distress and parents can figure out that this has been from school-based aggression?
Great. Well, to start, the parent should be in contact with the school well before any sort of incident might even come up. And that means being proactive in terms of finding out who the designated employees are, finding out what type of training designated employees have received or all educators in the building have received, that you have some sense of what should happen before an incident takes place. Once your child does come home, then the very first thing is to ask your child whether or not they reported to an adult in the building. Simply don't assume that the school already knows what happens. Verify with your child whether or not he or she told an adult at the school. Collect all the information and write it down in terms of the event, what took place, who was involved, and then contact the school on behalf of your child and say, you know, I'd like to report an incident. The school will determine, the designated employee will determine whether or not the behavior was rude and disrespectful, or if the behavior had some sort of legal standing like harassment or bullying or hazing. But if your child is the target of some sort of aggression, then, you know, beyond making sure the child is okay, asking your child whether or not they report it to an adult at school, then following up with sitting down and just writing what happened, both from the child's perspective as well as how you as an adult are feeling. And then when you go to the school, we always highly recommend that you take another adult with you. It could be a member of the clergy, could be a friend, could be a coworker, just to lend some perspective on what happens in the meeting. Oftentimes parents are so emotionally charged that sometimes they're not hearing with full faculty to what's happening. So to have a trusted friend with you can help to verify whether or not your interpretation of what was said and heard was in fact the same.
So, Jeff Lawrence, from your perspective then, I mean, so we're having sort of mirror perspectives here, because Curtis Reed is saying, here's what parents should do, and they go to the school, and this is, you know, this is often what happens. So why don't you lead us through from the school's perspective, what happens when a parent or a child, because sometimes children report aggression themselves, what does the school do?
Actually, about half the time it's the children don't report, about half the time parents come in or maybe make a phone call or maybe see me out front in the morning and come up and talk to me about it and report. And as soon as that report is made, we begin by gathering as much information as possible, talking to the student about it, gathering names of other people who might have witnessed what happened or might have been involved, and begin an investigation. Initially, it's like, let's gather as much general information as we can and then start doing the interviews. And it's while doing those interviews that we can start determining whether or not is something that has been repeated over time, which would lend itself to bullying. The intention was to humiliate the student, therefore that also would lead to bullying. And if the student was not a member of one of those, I think there are 9 different categories, we decided whether where it fits in that, or once again, is it just an issue of some sort of student conduct problem that doesn't rise up to the level of bullying or harassment or hazing? And at the same time, we have to follow up with sending the information home to the parents, sending a copy of our policy home to the parents, so they have all of that. And actually, after looking through the brochure, What Should Happen When Your Child Reports School-Based Aggression, Mr. Reed, I would like to send that home to my parents, too, if I can, because I think that has great information in it and takes all the steps, and it really breaks it down from the 10 pages of policy that I send home to just 2 sides of paper.
Curtis Reed, I imagine that'd be okay with you.
Yes, it would certainly be okay with us. And we've posted the brochure pamphlet online. But in addition to that, the Vermont Bar Association has stepped up and will do a print run of 5,000 of these brochures to distribute around the state. Our previous runs on the brochure have been about 30,000. So we have the first 5,000 sort of assured by Vermont Bar Association, but we're looking for others to cover the other 25,000 that we would like to distribute.
Hmm. Let's go to Craig, who's on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Craig. Go right ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Your thoughts?
So basically, I was very recently in high school. I'm 23 years old. And my school had a policy of a zero tolerance bullying policy. The problem with that was whenever I would report an incident of bullying, I was bullied a lot for being sort of a shy new kid. I moved there recently. The administration usually replied, well, that's impossible. We have a zero bullying policy. So I think it's kind of hard for kids when a lot of times the administration kind of feels invalidating, like the bullying's not possible or just couldn't happen. Thank you guys so much for having me on. I'm a big fan of the show.
Craig, I'm sorry to hear about your experiences, but thanks for sharing them. Jeff Lawrence, to you first, you know, what about that, the school response and this idea that, well, that couldn't be happening here. We have a zero tolerance policy.
Well, zero tolerance in my mind certainly doesn't mean that it can't happen. But when I meet with students, when I take a statement, one of the first things we talk about is if there is any retaliation based upon this report, then you immediately come back to us, and it sort of ups the ante as to what's going on here. We also talk to any witnesses and say, and for, you know, the information that if there's any sort of retaliation of any sort from anyone, then we're back investigating again.
And Curtis, what do you think? What comes to mind when you hear Craig?
Well, the first thing that I hear is this sense of having a blind spot that, you know, bullying can't happen here. We just don't allow it. It's the kind of implicit bias around things of an ugly nature don't happen here because we say that it doesn't happen here. And we've also, you know, in the past, one of the great things about this, you know, Act 91, when it was passed back in 2004, is that it gave parents the tools to hold schools accountable when, you know, aggressive behavior took place. That, yes, the behavior took place, and now you at the school, you know, you are required to do X, Y, and Z. But to deny that it even happened is kind of ridiculous.
We're talking today about bullying and harassment in schools. If you have an experience or a question to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Terry says, I'd like to share that from my perspective as a teacher, both in public and private elementary schools, parents should insist that their child's school put a very high value on the school atmosphere. A once-a-week classroom visit by a guidance counselor won't change the culture of a school. It takes a systemic belief switch. The social atmosphere in schools must be viewed as equally important and likely more so than the academic atmosphere of the school. To effect change, all teachers and grade levels need to be on board. We're talking about all of this today. We're looking at how to address bullying from the parents' perspective as well as how schools are doing it. And coming up, we're going to hear from the Secretary of the Agency of Education for Vermont about how much of a priority the state puts on this. And we're going to get Curtis Reed's thoughts on where he sees that perhaps we're not putting quite enough emphasis into this. Again, if you'd like to share your perspective, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also go to vpr.net and post a comment there or see the pamphlet that we've been talking about with resources and advice for parents on what happens when your child reports school-based aggression. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about bullying and harassment and how parents can approach the situation when their kids report being bullied at school. Curtis Reed's organization, the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, put out a pamphlet advising parents on the steps they can take. We have a link to it at vpr.net. And we're finding out what schools do to address bullying, hazing, and harassment as well. Jeff Lawrence is associate principal at Otter Valley Union High School in Brandon. Jeff is one of two designated employees at the school. Those are staff members who are specially trained to handle these complaints and who have to address them when they come up at the school. If you'd like to weigh in with your experience or ask a question, you can call 1-800 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or carry on the conversation going on Vermont Edition's Facebook page. Curtis Reed, we're going to speak in just a moment to Rebecca Holcomb, the Secretary of Education for the state of Vermont. But I'd love for you to share your perspective first on whether or not you think the state is doing enough, sort of large-scale view, to address bullying and harassment in schools.
Thank you. I don't think the agency is doing enough. First, we need credible data. We need data around who the designated employees are. We need data around what level of training that they've received, the level of training that all educators throughout the state have received, both in terms of sort of the statutory requirements around bullying, harassment, and hazing, but also in terms of sort of the long-term strategic, building of a social community within the school. And I loved Terry's comments about where the emphasis needs to be. There are changes in personnel every year, kind of rotating designated employees. It's sort of a moving target. We have no sort of quality standards for training in these matters in terms of, how do you handle a complaint. The Human Rights Commission, when Tracy Sagawa was here, did an incredible job on sort of training school administrators and designated employees. But she relocated to the West Coast, and her position, the current Human Rights Commission, is not taking on that role that she had played. So we've got this sort of vacuum. We have, from our partnership, we also provide training, but we'd really like to see the state and the Agency of Education establish some quality level criteria so that everyone will know what's expected and what they need to know and how that should be delivered to them.
Well, let's put that right to the Secretary. Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb joins us now on the phone. Secretary Holcomb, first of all, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
As Curtis Reed mentioned, the woman who was working on bullying and harassment for the state's Human Rights Commission, Tracy Tsugawa, has left. And my understanding is that the staffer with the Agency of Education who was in charge of bullying policy and prevention has also left the agency and not been replaced. Is it an appropriate conclusion to reach that this is not a priority for the state?
I think there's several issues. I mean, I think we have to go back, first of all, back in 2007 under the Douglas administration, the entire division of the agency related to safe schools was eliminated, and that funding has not been restored. What we have done in the interim is try to find ways to piece back in the pieces. In terms of the actual policies and requirements, we did just develop this past summer and promulgated statewide a revised hazing and harassment and bullying policy that we feel actually better addresses the intent because it really streamlines the processes that our local administrators need to go through to actually document and report and follow through. And that was a partnership with the Vermont School Boards Association and FSBET to really put together a robust policy. We got feedback from administrators in developing it and also shared it with the Hazing, Harassment, and Bullying Commission Task Force for feedback as well. And we have heard from the field that it's been a huge boon to have that. We've also collaborated with FSBET, and they've put together and we've reviewed a toolkit, a bullying toolkit that provides a series of tools that local administrators can use as they begin to have these conversations locally. We are actually going to put out this fall, and we're waiting till the school year starts and the dust settles, but a statewide assurance document that superintendents will have to reply to, which addresses who the designated reporters are, how they were publicized, so that how do we know that people in those communities know who they are, and we expect them to respond to that, and we'll follow up if they don't. So we will have more of that information moving forward. I think it is true that Tracy was a wonderful trainer, and that is a gap in the state. We do hope that there will be some capacity to support that, but we also have tried to provide clear, more comprehensible, and easier to implement guidelines that in the interim administrators can do. But I want to go back to what the previous participant had said online. I missed the name because I came in late, but talking about the school atmosphere being really, really critical. And when we look at our own data on bullying, we see several patterns. And first of all, that there are a small proportion of our students that report they've been targeted. So the majority of incidents that we see statewide are really targeting a handful of students. And so I wanted to just pick up on something you said. You said that you were talking about what parents can do. I think the first thing is, if you do hear that your child is reporting being bullied, you need to know that it's possible that they really are being bullied, first and foremost, but that it may be happening in multiple places, in multiple environments, both in and out of school, because that's the pattern that we do see in our data. And so it's really, really important as a parent to get involved and reach out to your school and make sure that the school is responding in a very proactive way to support your child, and that as a parent, you really know that your child is being protected. So I can't emphasize enough how important that is. In terms,
Rebecca
of what,
Holcomb, let me pause you for a second here. I want to bring Jeff Lawrence back into the conversation, associate principal at Otter Valley Union High School. Mm-hmm. Jeff, we heard from Curtis his frustration with not having really robust data on this from the state. Do you feel like, in your role as a school administrator, when it comes to bullying, harassment, and hazing, that you are well enough supported, and do you think that there's more that you would like to see at the state level?
That's a good question. First of all, we'd like to say that, excuse me, I was fortunate to be trained by Tracy, and she did a great job, and that was a little over 2 years ago.
And again, this is Tracy Tsugawa at the Human Rights Commission, and she's since left that post.
That's right.
And but at this point, I'm comfortable with what's happening in terms of the state supporting us. I'm glad for the new policy looking at the two elements in the same way, in the same process. I would like to have an idea of what's going on at other schools so we can, make some comparisons and think about, okay, well, what are we seeing? And maybe get some support that way.
So, like a conference?
One of the things that we're doing at the state level also is we're developing our education quality review process, and certainly one of the standards or the criteria that the state board spoke to in the education quality standards is this whole issue of school climate. And I think both Curtis and the caller alluded to this, but really we need to work on creating communities where every adult sees every child really as their own child and wants to make sure that they're thriving in a healthy environment. And one of the things that there are two components to that. We're looking at what quantitative data we have with respect to school climate, and that's going to address some of the data on bullying and harassment that I just spoke about. But it's also going to include site visits or field reviews, and we're going to look at local measures. So one of the things we've been piloting is a school climate survey, which captures evidence around bullying and hazing harassment in specifically, but also addresses these larger issues of school climate. And we also know many of our systems have that already. And part of the way we're designing these field visits and these field reviews is to create an opportunity for educators from different school sites to actually visit across school sites as part of this process, so that if a school is really struggling with school climate, we would try to bring them to a school that maybe has done some interesting work on school climate so they could actually see what educators in that context are doing and learn from it and see some actionable data and maybe come away with some really concrete ideas for what they might try when they go back to their school. And similarly, if that's their goal is to improve their school climate and that's what's indicated in their data locally, this would be an opportunity to bring in educators from other sites to review their own work and give them very concrete, actionable feedback on how they could improve. Because I think what Jeff has just said is both, I think, the great opportunity and sort of the great weakness in Vermont. We actually have schools that are doing incredibly exciting work in this area, and the question is, how can we learn from each other? We have good, dedicated educators. We need to help them learn from each other across sites and share effective practices across sites, particularly in, I think, in some of our smaller contexts where you may be the only teacher working at your grade level. You may not have a lot of colleagues that you can work with to think about developmentally appropriate strategies for supporting much more positive social behavior and interaction.
That's Rebecca Holcomb. She's Vermont's Secretary of Education. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I want to get to Jake, who's been waiting on the line with us from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Jake. Thanks for your patience.
My son was small in stature in middle school and got beat up across the street from the school. When I spoke to the assistant principal, the first reaction was, well, it's not on school property, and therefore we can't do anything. And my son didn't want me getting involved because he feared recrimination from this bigger kid. As a parent, I wanted my son to know it's not okay to be a victim, and I wanted to nip it in the bud. So I told the assistant principal, look, I'm going to make a stink. And I'm going to go to the police. I'm going to go to the newspapers. I'm going to track down the parents of this kid. And principal called in both my son and the kid and said, look, this guy's going to make trouble for you. You're already in enough trouble. Put a stop to it. And we nipped it in the bud. What I hear on the program is very bureaucratic with a lot of forms, and sometimes not as a vigilante, but as a parent, I think you just have to intervene directly.
Jake, thanks for your call. I appreciate that, and thank you for sharing your experience. I want to get both Curtis and Jeff, both of you, your thoughts on that. Lots coming up here, both in how schools handle things, but also in just how to approach this and how parents can make sure that they're getting the results that they want. Mm-hmm. Jeff, you haven't had a moment to talk here in a little while. What are you thinking?
Well, I was just listening to what happened to the young man. I was just amazed to someone to suggest that they're not responsible for what happened. It appeared to be on his way home from school, and we are responsible for that. And I know we would intervene, and especially if we're in this case of an assault, I know we have a school resource officer who would probably be involved. So that goes beyond, you know, the bullying and harassment and all that. Actually, would reach to that level, and we'd move to that level quickly.
And Jeff, when something happens on the internet, say that's between two students in your school, but
yeah,
can't be traced to school, how do you address that?
That's our responsibility, and we, you know, approach it the same way in terms of investigating and interviewing. It was last year around this time that Rutland had a big problem with the after-school app, and they responded to it incredibly quickly and got that shut down. And then about 7 months later, we had a similar problem here at Outer Valley, and we were able to put together a student response team and people signing pledges to only make positive comments online, and pretty much we were able to shut that down at our school. So it is that culture again, as the secretary was saying, and that changes things.
Yeah, and again, these are phone apps or internet apps that students can use to chat with one another, and often these are platforms for bullying and aggression. Curtis Reed, I heard you reacting when Jake was talking as well.
Yes, my first reaction is there's an administrator who doesn't know or understand the law.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a nexus with what happened with that student that related directly back to the school. And for administrators or educators to say, well, it didn't happen on our physical property, so we don't have to deal with it, is patently wrong.
Mm.
The other piece to this is, yes, there's a lot of strategic work that is going on around kind of long-term social climate in the building. But the brochure really focuses on what happens when there's a breach in that fabric, and parents need to be prepared and know what should happen, because oftentimes school administrators and educators do not know. The school board has passed policy, but administrators have not, they themselves studied the policy to know what is expected of them, and that's the first thing that parents need to do moving into this new school year.
At what point do parents think about taking action on another level, getting a lawyer or going to somebody else?
Well, if they're not satisfied with the investigation or the way the investigation is taking place, they should go to the Vermont Human Rights Commission to file a complaint, or they can file a complaint, a federal anti-harassment complaint through the Office of Civil Rights in Boston, through the Department of Education, and then they can also at any point decide to secure the services of a private attorney. And the Vermont Bar Association's referral service is a point of contact for those parents.
Jeff Lawrence, is this a problem that schools alone can solve, or do you need to have some kind of conversation with parents about, you know, what's happening in our schools and how that ties back to our community at large?
Oh, it's definitely not something we can solve by ourselves. especially as we mentioned earlier with everything going on outside of school and on the weekends. I think it's an entire community effort of people coming together. And, there's some shirts out there now, you know, hey, just be nice. And we start looking at a change in culture where people are being kinder or nicer to each other, and that can help in this situation.
Jeff Lawrence is associate principal at Otter Valley Union High School in Brandon. Curtis Reed is the executive director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity. We have a link to the pamphlet on dealing with school-based aggression that his organization put out. It's at vpr.net. Jeff and Curtis, thank you both for being on the program.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, when an exotic animal gets loose in Vermont, who are you going to call? Chad Barrett. And we'll be talking with him next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We don't have a lot of pink-kneed tarantulas, bearded dragons, Burmese pythons, or brown caiman in Vermont. But when there is one that needs to be captured or confiscated, Chad Barrett is the guy to do it. He's a warden with Vermont Fish and Wildlife, and he's their exotic animal expert, and he joins me now. Warden Barrett, what a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So people may have heard that you were sort of spearheading the recovery of a very large reticulated python in Vermont a couple weeks ago now, maybe the largest snake ever recovered in Vermont?
Yeah, I think it was. It's definitely the largest one that I've dealt with since I've been doing this. Yeah, that was one that somebody had taken custody of and realized, I think, very quickly after they'd had it for a day or so that it was just too large for them to handle safely. And so they contacted us right off, and we got some resources that we have out of state from a reptile sanctuary to come up. And I employed a couple other wardens from the area, and it took about five of us to handle that thing.
How much did it weigh?
It was roughly about 225 pounds.
Wow.
After we got it down to the sanctuary, they measured it that night, and the female, which was a larger one, was 19 feet 3 inches long. And then there was a 14.5-foot male that was about 170 pounds.
When you get a call like that, that there's a very large snake and you're going to have to go deal with it, are you excited? Do you get nervous?
No, I get excited. I've been, I guess, handling reptiles since I was a small child growing up here in Vermont. So I get excited about it. When I came on 8 years ago, there wasn't really anybody handling the exotic wildlife. So I volunteered to do it, and they sent me off to do some training out of state. So I had a lot of stuff for how to identify them, number one, and handle them, number two. So, yeah, it's excited to me. But when somebody says I have a large, huge, or enormous, whatever word they use, I always have to remember that, are they using a real scale or their snake scale? Because to me, a huge snake was like the one you just spoke of, a 20-foot snake. To some people, a huge snake is a 6-inch garter snake on their lawn.
That's true. So you got some training to do this, but you know, if you're working with native species, you can really become an expert in the species that we have here, because
right,
there's a limited number of them. You generally know what they are. How do you get yourself trained up so that you, I mean, you may not be an expert in every single species, but so that you have a sense of how to deal with everything from reptiles to arachnids to maybe a weird wild animal that has been trafficked or that is here and shouldn't be? I mean, how do you even know how to deal with all those species?
Again, I got sent out of state and did some great training down at the Rainforest Reptile Shows in Massachusetts through the owners there. They did some excellent identification stuff and had me do some hands-on stuff. And that was handling a lot of, I handled a lot of rattlesnakes, handled a cobra, handled a lot of constrictors, alligators, and tons of other lizards and some arachnids. And I also use a facility over in New Hampshire that does educational stuff, the Upper Valley Reptile Group. And she has a lot, Christina, who runs that, has a lot of animals over there that I can go over and handle. And I've brought her a few that I've actually recovered, which she uses in her educational programs, or finds rehomes them, particularly ones that have been left behind or found outdoors. But along with that, I constantly have to keep up to date through multiple different zoological websites on what's this, what's that. And so I'm constantly training a lot of stuff online or through local colleges or whatever, contacting people of that trade. And sometimes when I have something, I have to send pictures almost around the world to say, hey, I think I know what this is. This is close. Am I right or not? And so usually they'll help me out. We had a particular situation where I was notified that a lady had gotten bit by a scorpion and she was in the hospital here in Burlington. They weren't exactly sure what to do or how to handle that because it depends on what type of scorpion it is.
Mm-hmm.
So
which type of antivenom they'd want to use.
Exactly. Or how to just treat it. And if they didn't need antivenom, is it one that's not as much venomous, so you treat it like a wasp sting, or is it one that really needs some more intense in hospital treatment? So we figured all that out, and you know, between me and the New England Poison Center and some doctors in Mexico and overseas, we figured out what it was. So it's constantly staying in touch with people. It ended up being a, I'd say, Central American scorpion, which also has a group that has grown in Central Florida. They also live there now. So we figure it got on the plane that she just got off from some spring breaker, probably in Mexico, and crawled into her jacket pocket. And when she stuck her hand in there, it stung her.
Ooh, I can see people are probably cringing as they listen to this.
I can imagine.
So are you mostly dealing with people who have gotten pets and then have realized this isn't something that I can handle? Or are there other situations? Are you dealing with wildlife trafficking that, you know, are problematic in Vermont?
It's a little bit of both. Some of it is people trafficking some of our native wildlife out in exchange for a different type of exotic wildlife that isn't here. We've seen some of that. We've also seen a lot more in the pet trade where somebody got something, you know, it was a cute 10-inch alligator 5, 6, 7 years ago. Now it's a 5-foot crocodile that I have in my apartment in Burlington, and I'm moving and my new landlord won't let me have it. What do I do? So I was contacted in a scenario like that about 5 years ago when I ended up taking a 5.5-foot brown caiman out of an apartment, which was a crocodile of sorts. So, yeah, it's mostly seems to be lately the pet trade. Somebody in the pet trade has something that they either no longer want or realized wasn't what they wanted it to be when they first got it. And I've had a couple scenarios where they purchased it or picked it up from someone else, didn't really look at it, got it home, opened the container, and they're like, that's not what I thought it was.
Are these always animals that are illegal in Vermont, or are you also helping people who, you know, again, may have a legal animal but can't handle it, and rather than, you know, ditch it in a local pond where, I mean, there have been cases in other states at least where species have been introduced in that kind of way and have started to take over.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that we don't want to do. But yeah, in most cases, some of them are illegal. Some of them are not illegal. Depends on the species. And we have lists on our website that tell what's restricted, what's not restricted. Some of them are restricted species. Some of them are non-restricted. And just trying to help them home them before they want to go out and release them into the wild, or they want to kill them just because they don't want to care for them anymore or whatever. So we try to find avenues and facilities where we can get those out before. We found an alligator years ago that was shot in the head and left on the side of the road. Not sure exactly what happened. I'm guessing it got too big or was costing too much or did something, you know, bit the family dog. I don't know. So they got rid of it. And we found a 12-foot Burmese python on the side of the road in central Vermont a couple springs ago, which was dead. Of course, it looked like it was released probably the fall before, never made it through winter. So the scenarios are different, but it includes both of those legal and illegal species.
Could you tell me about the pink-kneed tarantula? I didn't even know that tarantulas had pink knees.
Well, yeah, it was a different species of tarantula. And that one actually was not one that I had to go confiscate or take from someone. That was actually one of Christina's over at Upper Valley Reptile Group. She was doing an educational display over at vet clinic in Norwich, Vermont, and it was one of the things that she had there, and I actually put it on my uniform, and the kids were watching, and then they took some pictures of it. So,
and tarantulas, if I remember correctly from my days in Los Angeles, look scarier than they actually are. They don't, they can't bite people, or they often don't.
They can, but they often don't. They're more docile than not usually. So, yeah.
So when you see a deer or a bear now in Vermont, are you like, ugh, whatever, I see those all the time. Give me a tarantula or a caiman.
There are days when I feel like that, yes.
We've been talking with Chad Barrett. He's a warden with Vermont Fish and Wildlife, and he is the exotic animal specialist with the Fish and Wildlife Department. Thank you so much for telling us a little bit about your job.
Not a problem. Thank you for inviting me.
And that will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, a discussion with state highway safety officials about the dramatic rise in speeding on the interstate, continued use of handheld cell phones, lack of seatbelt use, and distracted driving in general. You can send your questions, comments, or your experiences to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.